3. The Christmas Truce, the One-Hour Experiment, and the Missileers. The Christmas Truce. Of all the difficult and dangerous battlefields in history, the Flanders Trenches during the winter of 1914 might top the list. Military scholars tell us that this is due to the fact that World War I marked the historical intersection of modern weapons and medieval strategy. But in truth, it was mostly due to the mud. The Flanders Trenches were located below sea level, dug out of greasy clay so waterlogged that a rainstorm could transform them into canals. They were cold and miserable, an ideal breeding ground for rats, fleas, disease, and all manner of pestilence. The worst part, however, was the closeness of the enemy. Opposing troops were only a few hundred feet apart in many points, and occasionally much less. At one place near Vimy Ridge, two observation posts stood 7 meters apart. Grenades and artillery were a constant threat. A carelessly lit match was an invitation for a sniper's bullet. As future Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, then a lieutenant in the Grenadier Guards, wrote, "One can look for miles and see no human being, but in those miles of country lurk, it seems, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of men, planning against each other perpetually some new device of death. Never showing themselves, they launch at each other bullet, bomb, aerial torpedo, and shell." Beneath the mud resided deeper layers of historical hatred between the Allies and the Germans. English and French newspapers printed fervent myths about how German barbarians were melting down innocent victims to make soap. For their part, German schoolchildren were reciting Ernst Lissauer's Hymn of Hate, which was only slightly less subtle. "You we will hate with a lasting hate. We will never forego our hate. Hate by water and hate by land. Hate of the head and hate of the hand. Hate of the hammer and hate of the crown. Hate of 70 millions choking down. We love as one, we hate as one. We have one foe and one alone, England." The war began in August. As the weeks and months passed, the two sides systematically killed each other and were killed, the bodies strewn in the barbed wire of no man's land. As Christmas approached, voices in distant capitals argued for a temporary ceasefire. In Rome, Pope Benedict appealed for holiday peace. In Washington, D.C., a Senate resolution requested a 20-day break in the fighting. Military leaders on both sides swiftly deemed this idea impossible and informed their troops to expect surprise attacks on Christmas. Any soldier who attempted to create an illicit truce, they warned, would be court-martialed. Then, on Christmas Eve, something happened. It's difficult to determine precisely where it began, but it appeared to have been spontaneous, occurring independently at several places along the front. It started with songs. Some were Christmas carols, some were military songs. In most places, the singing went back and forth for a while, with each side applauding or jeering the other's renditions. Then something even stranger happened. The soldiers began to climb out of their trenches and approach each other in a friendly way. Outside a town called La Chapelle d'Armentière, English soldiers heard a German voice call out in English, "I am a lieutenant. Gentlemen, my life is in your hands, for I am out of my trench and walking toward you. Will one of your officers meet me halfway?" Rifleman Percy Jones figured it was a surprise attack. As he later wrote, "We commenced polishing up ammunition and rifles and getting all ready for speedy action. In fact, we were about to loose off a few rounds at the biggest light when words were heard, probably through a megaphone. Englishmen, Englishmen, don't shoot. You don't shoot, we don't shoot." Then followed a remark about Christmas. This was all very well, but we had heard so many yarns about German treachery that we kept a very sharp lookout. How it happened, I don't know, but shortly after this, our boys had lights out, and the enemy troops were busy singing each other's songs. punctuated with terrific salvos of applause. The scene from my sentry post was hardly creditable. Straight ahead were three large lights, with figures perfectly visible around them. The German trenches were illuminated with hundreds of little lights. Far away to the left, where our lines bent, a few lights showed our A Company trenches, where the men were thundering out my little gray home in the west. At the conclusion, the Saxons burst into loud cheers and obliged with some German tune. They also sang one of their national airs to the tune of God Save the King. We replied with the Austrian hymn, at which the applause was terrific. Back at British High Command, Field Marshal Sir John French received puzzling reports that unarmed German soldiers were running from the German trenches across to ours, holding Christmas trees above their heads. French issued immediate orders to prevent any recurrence of such conduct and called the local commanders to strict account. His orders had no effect. The truce grew. The soldiers involved seemed to have no more idea why this was happening than Sir John French did. They saw it happen and participated in it, and it still felt utterly inexplicable. Diarists on both sides would refer to the surreality of the event, many describing it as kind of a waking dream. For many years, historians assumed that the story of the Christmas truce was exaggerated, an isolated instance that had been inflated by soft-headed newspaper writers. But as they dug deeper, they found the opposite was true. The truce was far bigger than had been reported, involving tens of thousands of men along two-thirds of the British-held line. The interactions included eating, drinking, cooking, singing, playing soccer matches, exchanging photos, bartering, and burying the dead. One soldier who didn't appreciate the truce was German Corporal Adolf Hitler, who was in reserve near the Flanders front. "Such a thing should not happen in wartime," he is alleged to have said to his fellow soldiers who joined in. "Have you no German sense of honor left at all?" In the annals of history, there are few cases where all-out violence pivoted so swiftly and completely to familial warmth. The deeper question is how it happened. The traditional way of explaining the Christmas truce is to see it as a story about how the shared meaning of the holiday can awaken the better angels of our nature. This way of thinking is attractive, but it fails to explain what actually occurred. There were plenty of other battlefields throughout history where enemies experienced shared spiritual holidays, yet did not engage in anything remotely approaching this level of connection. The picture shifts, however, if we look at it through the lens of belonging cues. One of the most detailed accounts can be found in Trench Warfare 1914-1918 by Tony Ashworth. Over the course of 288 pages, Ashworth provides the historical equivalent of a slow-motion replay of the forces that triggered the Christmas truce. He shows that it began not on Christmas, but weeks before, when a steady flow of interactions created bonds of safety, identity, and trust. Ashworth likens the arrival of the Christmas truce to the sudden surfacing of the whole of an iceberg, visible to all, including non-combatants, which for most of the war remained largely submerged. Ashworth details the physical closeness of the two sides. While the closeness brought violence, it also brought connection, through the smells of cooking and the sounds of voices, laughter, and songs. Soldiers on both sides became aware that they followed the same daily rhythms and routines of meals, resupply, and troop rotations. Both sides dealt with the combination of numbing routine and raw terror that made up military life. Both sides hated the cold and wet. Both sides longed for home. As Ashworth puts it, "The process of mutual empathy among antagonists was facilitated by their proximity in trench war, and further, was reinforced as the assumptions made by each of the other's likely actions were confirmed by subsequent events. Moreover, by getting to know the neighbor in the trench opposite, each adversary realized that the other endured the same stress, reacted in the same way, and thus was not so very different from himself. Micro-truces began in early November. The British and Germans had a habit of delivering rations to the trenches around the same time. While the troops ate, the shooting would stop. The next day, the same thing happened at precisely the same time. And the next day. And the next. From meals, the micro-truces spread to other behaviors. When heavy rainfall made movement difficult, both sides would stop fighting. On cold nights in some sectors, troops from both sides would venture forth to gather dry straw for bedding, and both would withhold fire so they could work in peace. The tacit ceasefires grew to include supply lines, off-limits, latrines, same, and the gathering of casualties after a battle. Those interactions sound casual, but in fact each involves an emotional exchange of unmistakable clarity. One side stops shooting, leaving itself exposed. The other side senses that exposure, but does nothing. Each time it happens, both experience the relief and gratitude of safe connection. They saw me. The connections grew. In several sectors, certain areas were designated as out of bounds for sniper fire and designated with white flags. One English artillery unit spoke of its pet sniper on the German side, who would send his goodnight kiss every night promptly at 9:15 p.m., then shoot no more until the following morning. In another sector, an English machine gunner would shoot out the rhythm of a popular song called Policeman's Holiday, and his German counterpart would provide an answering refrain. The trenches became a petri dish of belonging cues. Each cue, by itself, would not have had much of an impact. But together, repeated day after day, they combined to create conditions that set the stage for a deeper connection. In the soldiers' accounts, it's possible to see these connections strengthen. One morning after a violent battle at the end of November, Edward Hulse, a captain in the 2nd Scots Guard, wrote about an impromptu moment of empathy. The morning after the attack, there was an almost tacit understanding as to no firing, and at about 6:15 a.m., I saw 8 or 9 German shoulders and heads appear, and then 3 crawled out a few feet in front of their parapet and began dragging in some of our fellows who were either dead or unconscious. I passed down the order that none of my men were to fire, and this seems to have been done all down the line. I helped one of the men in myself, and was not fired on at all. That incident seems to have affected Hulse. Several weeks later, from a post behind the lines, he hatched a plan. He wrote, "We return to the trenches tomorrow, and shall be in them on Christmas Day. Germans or no Germans, we are going to have a hell of a bust, including plum puddings for the whole battalion. I have got a select little party together who, led by my stentorian voice, are going to take up a position in our trenches where we are closest to the enemy, about 80 yards, and from 10 p.m. onwards, we are going to give the enemy every conceivable form of song in harmony, from carols to Tipperary. My fellows are most amused with the idea, and will make a rare noise when we get at it. Our object will be to drown the now far too familiar strains of Deutschland über alles, and the Wacht am Rhein we hear from their trenches every evening." The Germans responded with their own barrage of songs. Some were similar, and the Latin songs were identical. From a psychological perspective, they conveyed a meaning that both sides understood, a shared burst of belief and identity. Hulse walked out and met his counterpart, a German major. The Germans helped the English bury their dead, and the German commander handed Hulse a medal and some letters belonging to an English captain who had died and fallen into the German trench a week earlier. Overcome with emotion, Hulse took off his silk scarf and handed it to the German. "It was absolutely astounding," he later wrote, "and if I had seen it on a cinematograph film, I should have sworn that it was faked. A few miles away, near Plukestirt Wood, Corporal John Ferguson crouched in his trench, trying to figure out what was happening. He later wrote, "We shouted back and forward until old Fritz, the German officer, clambered out of the trench, and accompanied by three others of my section, we went out to meet him. 'Make for the light,' he called, and as we came nearer, we saw he had his flash lamp in his hand, putting it in and out to guide us. We shook hands, wishing each other a Merry Christmas, and were soon conversing as if we had known each other for years. We were in front of their wire entanglements and surrounded by Germans, Fritz and I in the center talking, and Fritz occasionally translating to his friends what I was saying. We stood inside the circle like street corner orators. Where they couldn't talk the language, they were making themselves understood by signs, and everyone seemed to be getting along nicely. Here we were, laughing and chatting to men whom only a few hours before we were trying to kill." Hulse and Ferguson, like so many others, were astounded. But it was not really astounding. At the point when the English and the Germans stepped out onto that field, they had already been in conversation for a long time, both sides sending volleys of belonging cues that lit up their amygdalas with a simple message. We are the same. We are safe. I'll go halfway if you will. And so they did. The final chapter of this story is less inspiring but equally informative. The generals on both sides, on learning of the truce, put a stop to it with relative ease. They ordered raids, rotated troops to stop fraternization, and swiftly destroyed the foundation of belonging that had been so incrementally built. The following Christmas, both sides fought as usual. The 1 hour experiment. If you had to pick an environment that is the opposite of the Flanders trenches, you might pick the WIPRO, pronounced Wipro, call center in Bangalore, India. Wipro is the model of a successful call center. It is organized, it is highly efficient. The days consist of the same work that happens in call centers all over the world. A caller phones in with issues about a device or a service, and Wipro's agents attempt to remedy it. Wipro is by almost every measure a nice place to work. It features competitive salaries and high-quality facilities. The company treats employees well, providing good food, transportation, and social activities. But in the late 2000s, Wipro found itself facing a persistent problem. Its employees were leaving in droves, as many as 50 to 70% each year. They left for the usual reasons. They were young or taking a different job, and for reasons they couldn't quite articulate. At bottom, they lacked a strong connection to the group. Wipro's leaders initially tried to fix things by increasing incentives. They boosted salaries, added perks, and touted their company's award as one of India's best employers. All these moves made sense, but none of them helped. Employees kept leaving at precisely the same rate as before. And so, in the fall of 2010, with the help of researchers Bradley Statz, Francesco Gino, and Daniel Cable, they decided to embark on a small experiment. The experiment went like this. Several hundred new hires were divided into two groups, plus the usual control group. Group 1 received standard training plus an additional hour that focused on Wipro's identity. These trainees heard about the company's successes, met a star performer, and answered questions about their first impressions of Wipro. At the end of the hour, they received a fleece sweatshirt embroidered with the company's name. Group 2 also received the standard training, plus an additional hour focused not on the company, but on the employee. These trainees were asked questions like, "What is unique about you that leads to your happiest times and best performances at work?" In a brief exercise, they were asked to imagine they were lost at sea and to consider what special skills they might bring to the situation. At the end of the hour, they were given a fleece sweatshirt embroidered with their name alongside the company's name. Stats didn't expect the experiment to show much. High attrition is the norm in the call center world, and Wipro's attrition rates were firmly in line with industry averages. And besides, Stats wasn't inclined to believe a one-hour intervention could make a long-term impact. A former engineer who spent the first years of his career as an analyst at Goldman Sachs, he isn't some pie-in-the-sky academic. He knows how things work in the real world. I was pretty sure that our experiment was going to show a small effect, if any at all, Stats says. I saw the onboarding process in rational, transactional, informational terms. You show up at a new job on the first day, and there's a straightforward process where you learn how to act, how to behave, and that's all there is to it. 7 months later, the numbers came in, and Stats was, as he puts it, completely shocked. Trainees from Group 2 were 250% more likely than those from Group 1 and 157% more likely than those from the control group to still be working at Wipro. The hour of training had transformed Group 2's relationship with the company. They went from being non-committal to being engaged on a far deeper level. The question was why. The answer is belonging cues. The trainees in Group 1 received zero signals that reduced the interpersonal distance between themselves and Wipro. They received lots of information about Wipro and star performers, plus a nice company sweatshirt, but nothing that altered that fundamental distance. The Group 2 trainees, on the other hand, received a steady stream of individualized, future-oriented, amygdala-activating belonging cues. All these signals were small. A personal question about their best times at work, an exercise that revealed their individual skills, a sweatshirt embroidered with their name. These signals didn't take much time to deliver, but they made a huge difference because they created a foundation of psychological safety that built connection and identity. My old way of thinking about this issue was wrong, Stats says. It turns out that there are a whole bunch of effects that take place when we are pleased to be a part of a group, when we are part of creating an authentic structure for us to be more ourselves. All sorts of beneficial things play out from those first interactions. I talked with Dilip Kumar, one of the original Wipro trainees who had taken part in the experiment. I expected him to share vivid memories of the session, but talking to him about his orientation was a lot like talking to Jeff Dean about fixing the AdWords engine. His sense of belonging was so strong that he'd basically forgotten that the experiment had ever happened. To be honest, I don't remember much about that day, but I remember it felt motivating, said Kumar. He laughed. I guess it must have worked, because I am still here, and I definitely like it. The opposite of belonging. While it's useful to spend time with successful cultures, it's equally useful to travel to the other end of the spectrum, to examine cultures that fail. The most instructive may be those where the group fails with such consistency that it approaches a kind of perfection. This is where we find the story of the Minuteman Missileers. The Minuteman Missileers are the 750 or so men and women who work as nuclear missile launch officers. They are stationed at remote Air Force bases in Wyoming, Montana, and North Dakota, and their job, for which they are extensively trained, is to control some of the most powerful weapons on Earth, 450 Minuteman III missiles. The missiles are 60 feet tall, weigh 80,000 pounds, and can travel 15,000 miles per hour to any spot on the globe within 30 minutes, each delivering 20 times more explosive energy than the Hiroshima bomb. The Missileers are part of a system designed in the late 1940s by General Curtis LeMay, a larger-than-life figure whose mission was to make the American nuclear force a perfectly functioning machine. Every man a coupling or tube, every organization a rampart of transistors, battery of condensers, LeMay wrote. All rubbed up, no corrosion, alert. LeMay was called the toughest cop of the Western world by Life magazine, and his confidence was unbounded. One time, he stepped into a bomber with a lit cigar. When a crew member warned him that the bomber might explode, LeMay replied, "It wouldn't dare." LeMay's system worked well enough for several decades. But in recent years, failures began to occur with increasing regularity. August 2007. Crews at Minot Air Force Base mistakenly loaded 6 nuclear-tipped cruise missiles onto a B-52 bomber, flew them to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, and allowed them to sit unattended on a runway for several hours. December 2007. Minot's missile launch crews failed the subsequent inspection. Inspectors noted that at the time of the visit, some of Minot's security personnel were playing video games on their cell phones. 2008. A Pentagon report noted a dramatic and unacceptable decline in the Air Force's commitment to the nuclear mission. One Pentagon official was quoted as saying, "It makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck." 2009. 30 tons of solid rocket boosters ended up in a ditch near Minot when the tractor trailer carrying them drove off the road. 2012. A federally funded study revealed high levels of burnout, frustration, aggravation, and spousal abuse in the missileer force. And it showed the court-martial rates in the nuclear missile force were more than twice as high as in the rest of the Air Force. As one missileer told researchers, "We don't care if things go properly. We just don't want to get in trouble." 2013. Missile officers at Minot Air Force Base received a marginal rating, the equivalent of a D grade, when 3 of the 11 crews were rated unqualified. 19 officers were removed from launch duty and forced to retake proficiency tests. Lieutenant General James Kowalski, commander of the nuclear forces, says that the greatest nuclear threat to America is an accident. The greatest risk to my force is doing something stupid. 2014. Minuteman maintenance crews caused an accident involving a nuclear-armed missile in its silo. Every time a failure occurred, commanders responded by cracking down. As General Kowalski put it, "This is not a training problem. This is some people out there having a problem with discipline." After the string of incidents in the spring of 2013, Lieutenant Colonel Jay Folds wrote to the combat crew at Minot that they had fallen and it's time to stand ourselves back up. He described rot in the crew force and the need to crush any rules violators. "We need to hit the reset button and restructure the crew force to take you out of your comfort zones, which are rotten comfort zones, and rebuild from the ground up," Folds wrote. "Turn the TVs off and work hard on your proficiency. You better bring your A game every day. You must be ready on a moment's notice for any eval, any test, any field visit, any certification, etc. Gone is the academic environment of the past, or the environment where we handed things to you on a silver platter because we thought that's the way you take care of the crew force. Bring to my attention immediately any officer who badmouths a senior officer or badmouths the new culture we're trying to reconstruct. There will be consequences." From afar, it looked like an impressive, all-hands-on-deck, get-tough response. The problem was, none of it worked. The mistakes kept happening. A few months after the Folds Manifesto, Major General Michael Carey, who was responsible for overseeing the nation's intercontinental ballistic missiles, was fired for misconduct during an official trip to Moscow. Here is an excerpt from the 42-page Air Force report on Carey's misconduct. Carey appeared drunk and, in the public area of the Zurich airport, talked loudly about the importance of his position as commander of the only operational nuclear force in the world, and that he saves the world from war every day. In Moscow, he drank heavily and during a monastery tour attempted to fist bump his Russian tour guide. He repeatedly interrupted his hosts during their ceremonial toasts to make his own. He sought out the company of those he called two hot women and accompanied them to a bar called La Cantina. According to the report, he kept asking the band to allow him to come on stage to sing and play guitar with them. The report notes, the band did not allow Major General Kerry to play with them. Soon afterward, an Air Force investigation at Malmstrom Air Force Base implicated two missileers on charges of illegal possession, use, and distribution of cocaine, ecstasy, and bath salts. When investigators examined the cell phones of the accused officers, they uncovered an elaborate system for cheating on proficiency tests, sparking another investigation that ended up implicating 34 of Malmstrom's missileers, plus 60 more who knew about the cheating and failed to report it. Everyone agrees that missileer culture is broken. The deeper question is why. If you think about culture as an extension of a group's character, its DNA, you tend to see the missileers as lazy, selfish, and lacking in character. This leads to the type of get-tough remedies the Air Force leadership attempted, and their failure leaves you only to confirm the original assumption. The missileers are lazy, immature, and selfish. However, if we look at missileer culture through the lens of belonging cues, the picture shifts. Belonging cues have to do not with character or discipline, but with building an environment that answers basic questions. Are we connected? Do we share a future? Are we safe? Let's take them one by one. Are we connected? It is hard to conceive of a situation of less physical, social, and emotional connection than that of the missileers. They spend 24-hour rotations paired up in chilly, cramped missile silos with Eisenhower-era technology. These things have been lived in continuously for 40 years, one missileer told me. They get cleaned, but not really. Sewage lines are corroding. Asbestos is everywhere. People hate being there. Do we share a future? When the silos were built, the missileers were as crucial a part of America's defense as their pilot brethren. Receiving a launch order from the president was a real possibility. Serving as a missileer functioned as a stepping stone for a career in Space Command, Air Combat Command, and other areas. But the end of the Cold War changed the missileers' future. They are training for a mission that no longer exists. Not surprisingly, career paths out of missiles have dwindled or vanished entirely. The writing's on the wall, says Bruce Blair, a former missileer who is now a research scholar at the Program on Science and Global Security at Princeton. No one wants to stay in missiles. There's no chance of promotion. You're not going to make general coming through missiles. What's more, the command has shut down some of the options of cross-training out of nuclear into other commands, which has delivered the message that you guys are stuck on the island of misfit toys. For the first couple of months, it's kind of exciting, another former missileer told me. But the shine starts to come off pretty quickly. You do it over and over again. You realize this is not going to change. This is never going to change. Are we safe? The biggest risk in the missileer's world is not the missiles, but the constant barrage of proficiency, certification, and nuclear readiness tests, each of which requires near perfection, and each of which might scuttle their career. These tests often involve memorizing a 5-inch-thick binder filled with 2-sided sheets of launch codes. Missileers must score 100% on certain portions of the tests, or else they fail. The checklists are impossibly long and detailed, bizarrely rigid and strict. It's basically inhuman, Blair says. You're either perfect or you're a bum. The result is that when you get out of the spotlight of the authority and travel to a remote underground launch control center with one other person, you close that 8-ton blast door behind you. All the standards get dropped, and you start taking shortcuts. As one missileer told me, every deviation is treated as if it's violating a presidential launch order. Make a critical error, you're done. You're the shitty guy. There is no such thing as doing an outstanding job. You either do it right or you get punished. If you admit a mistake or ask for help, you ruin your reputation. Everyone walks around like scared puppies. So you get a feedback loop. Something bad happens, everybody screams and yells, Then they institute more evaluations, which makes everybody more demoralized, more tired, so you make more mistakes. It all adds up to a perfectly designed storm of anti-belonging cues, where there is no connection, no future, and no safety. Seen in this way, miscellaneous culture is not a result of an internal lack of discipline and character, but of an environment custom-built to destroy cohesion. Indeed, the former launch officers I spoke with were smart, eloquent, thoughtful people who seemed to have found successful and fulfilling lives once they left the broken miscellaneous culture. The difference wasn't in the content of their character. It was in the lack of safety and belonging in their culture. It's useful to contrast the miscellaneous dysfunctional culture with that of their Navy counterparts who work in nuclear submarines. At first glance, the two groups seem roughly similar. Both spend vast amounts of time isolated from the rest of society. Both are tasked with memorizing and executing tedious protocols, and both are oriented toward Cold War nuclear deterrence missions whose time has passed. Where they differ, however, is in the density of the belonging cues in their respective environments. Sailors in submarines have close physical proximity, take part in purposeful activity, global patrols that include missions beyond deterrence, and are part of a career pathway that can lead to the highest positions in the Navy. Perhaps as a result, the nuclear submarine fleet has thus far mostly avoided the kinds of problems that plague the miscellaneous, and in many cases have developed high-performing cultures. So far, we've explored the process for creating belonging. Now we'll turn to the more practical question of applying this process in the real world. We'll do this by meeting two leaders who build belonging in their groups using vastly different but equally effective methods. First, a basketball coach will give us an up-close insight into the skill of building relationships. Then, an unconventional retail billionaire will explain how he creates belonging at a higher level through systems and design.